Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Right, former teacher, forever punk, one of the country's greatest ever writers. He has received the Booker Prize and death threats. He created Barrytown, he told the memoirs of Kelly and Kino. He's written plays, films, children's books, and in a 37-year career has brought the world Charlo, Paula, Jimmy Rabbit, Paddy Clark, Charlie Savage and A1 Sharon. Roddy Doyle, good morning.
Hello.
We'll start kind of serious now. This is a serious novel. Paula Spencer, she has returned in your new novel, The Women Behind the Door. An important, very funny story as well, but a very important one as well. Can you remind us when you first introduced Ireland to this mother of four?
1994, May. Tuesday night. Can't remember. The first Tuesday in May, the first episode of Family, which I had written over a two-year period commissioned by the BBC, and then RTE became involved.
So how did she come into your head? And you're a novelist. Begins in TV form.
Yeah, it's usually the other way around. What happened was a friend of mine, Andrew Eaton, who eventually produced Family, wanted to work with me, and he arranged a meeting with Michael Waring, who worked at the BBC, who had produced Boys from the Black Stuff. A lot of people will remember that. An amazing drama. The best thing I'd ever seen on television at the time. And I remember its impact in the school I was teaching in. Kids were coming in the day after and quoting Yosser Hughes from, I could do that. Give us a job. And I just thought, geez, I was getting off the Dart and Tara Street, going up to O'Connell Street to meet this man. And I was thinking, God, I'm meeting the producer of Boys from the Black Stuff. You know, this was kind of science fictional almost for me. And I knew he was going to ask me to write something for the BBC. And on the way up, I thought, well, I'll write about the rabbits, you know, the rabbits of the commitments, the snapper and the van, that kind of happy family, so to speak, or successful, emotionally successful family. Yeah. I'll write about the neighbours where things aren't so rosy, or things are, or if a baby was born in that house, it might be more difficult than in the case of the snapper. Not literally their neighbours, but I just thought a different type of family. And I was thinking I'll have, each episode would have a different look and a different feel, a different soundtrack, because the camera will follow a different family member. And I just thought, father, first episode, mother, last episode, the two of the teenage children in the middle, boy, girl. Didn't have names for them, but that's as much as I had by the time I got up to the Gresham Hotel where I was meeting the man. Oh. And by the end of that meeting, I had a commission from the BBC to write four episodes. So I spent a year planning it, 3 months for each episode, and then a year writing, 3 months again for each episode. And when I got to the end of, when I was writing the final episode, which is Paula's story, most of the drama was over, you know, because she threw her husband, Charlo, out of the house, hit him over the head with the frying pan. Mm-hmm. I lifted that from Fawlty Towers.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. When you look around the kitchen and you want something that probably won't cause too much physical damage, that won't send the story off to a hospital or something.
Yeah.
Too many knives, too many things like that, but a good old frying pan.
This is a very serious domestic violence story, and you got one of the ideas.
Yeah, well, this is the way it works, really, yeah. It wasn't funny, the way it was done, it wasn't funny. But anyway, he was gone out of the house by the end of episode three. So episode four was more, it was less dramatic, more difficult to write because of that. There were no big, big moments in it. But I began to become really interested in Paula, the character, in this final episode. And I suppose as well, I was beginning to relax because I was on the home stretch.
Right.
And it wasn't a race, so there was nobody running up behind me to rob my bronze medal, you know. So it was, I began to wonder about, you know, what a lot of people wonder. They meet a couple and they wonder, God, Jesus, what did she ever see in him, or what did he ever see in her?
I see, yeah.
In that trivial kind of way. But then I began to, you know, thought, well, maybe there's a book in her. She's at a point in her life where the kids are in school. I could see her sitting down in the kitchen, copy book and a pen, and beginning to write. So I gave up teaching in 1994, and this was the first thing I sat down to write then after the holidays.
And you'd won the Booker Prize.
I hadn't at the time. I won the Booker Prize a month later. It was those years, in retrospect, just seemed so mad and packed. The Snapper was broadcast in May 1993. I won the Booker Prize in October, I think it was, 1993. I gave up teaching in 1993 and I started writing the book that became The Woman Who Walked Into Doors in 1993, and filming of Family started then as well.
Right.
You know, so it was mad.
It was a BBC production. It looks, looking back now, it looks like a really expensive, incredible show.
I think it was. I think the budget was 2 million for 4 episodes, which is, I never paid too much attention to budgets, but I think it was generous. But when RTE became involved, I remember one of the things that they could do, which now you could do with the drone, but you know, at the very beginning,
I was about to say, that's why I think it's expensive, because it's
the
aerial
shot
shots.
Of the, well, that was a helicopter going up
all over Dublin.
Now you could get a kid with a drone to do it for a Mars bar, you know. Then though, it costs quite a lot of money.
It also has a huge cast. I know we focus on
95 speaking parts.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And people,
so that's why, you know, among actors of a certain age,
they remember
they're
fondly.
Very fond of me.
He makes, he gives us all a line.
Yeah, yeah.
And what a leading cast.
Yeah. And again, extraordinary, really. I knew Jer, who played Paula. Mm. I'd seen her on stage. She worked with Paul Mercer in The Passion Machine. I knew she was brilliant. When I heard she'd got the job, I thought, great. I would never have chosen Sean McGinley. It would never have occurred to me. I saw him in the Playboy, The Western World. I'd seen him on stage, thought he was excellent. Never would have seen him as a dub.
No, you know,
that's the limit. Limits away. Michael Winterbottom, the director, saw him, and aren't we lucky? Because he was absolutely incredible. And then Barry Ward, who's now, you know,
huge star now,
middle-aged man.
He's the kid. John.
He was
Paul.
A child. Yeah, he was a child. And Nellie Conroy.
Nellie Conroy.
Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah, you know, who people would know from Fair City and other things. You know, so that core.
That Barry Ward, brilliant. That was his first role, by the way.
It was,
and,
yeah.
He's in Bad Sisters now, Apple Things, and all sorts of shows. Jer Ryan is who you're referencing there. Sean McGinley is just terrifying.
Yeah.
Isn't he?
Yeah.
Charlo is a fearsome character.
Oh, he's just extraordinary, because you can see, you know, in the first episode, the way he struts through the streets and people, you can see they kind of both fear him and admire him, and the way he carried that, because... if you're in Sean's company, that's not Sean. Do you know? I sat beside him when he saw the first episode for the first time, and he was so shaken by it. Yeah, as was I. I mean, you know, it's not an easy thing to watch when you're actually involved in it. So many different emotions going through you. And he was shaken by it. Proud, I hope, but also shaken by it, because, you know, he was seeing a version of himself that, you know, wasn't familiar, I suppose.
I saw it as a kid. I would have been 13 at the time, and it was on in our house.
You're making me feel so ancient.
But I do remember Charlo the most from the show. I remember three things. I remember Charlo being really scary. I remember Chips Don't Bounce.
Yeah.
And I remember the tomato exploding in the microwave.
Yeah.
Because of my 13-year-old
brain. Charlo became kind of a household name as well for a while then. He's a bit of a Charlo. That fella's a bit of a Charlo, you know. And... I think probably Sean was plagued by it for a few years as well.
RTE showed it before BBC.
Yeah.
So it's May 1994.
Yeah.
Is it the same week as Riverdance?
I think 3 or 4 days after, yeah.
Okay. And what is the reaction to this show?
Well, explosive, I think, would be the...
Yeah, yeah.
To put it mildly. I knew there would be a reaction. And the previous year, The Snapper had come out. I'd won the Booker Prize. Was everybody's granny's Christmas present that year. And I knew this wasn't going to have the same impact. And it was going to be a different kind of impact. So I was kind of braced for a surprise anyway or whatever. But you could never anticipate the level of hostility. And also... If you like, if praise can be measured by a Geiger counter or whatever, the praise, but the hostility in particular, you could never anticipate it really, or certainly back then, I could never have anticipated it.
What did people object to?
Everything. The language, suddenly, in a different context, the language was bad, whereas in the case of The Snapper, people didn't seem to object to it, but in this case, they certainly did. So the language, the depiction of... abuse. I got, you know, more than one letter claiming it didn't happen in Ireland, and that if I wanted to do it, I should have set it in England. The BBC should have set it in England, not in Ireland.
Yeah.
From the pulpit, apparently, there was several accusations that I was undermining Irish marriage, that's what I was trying to do. Then there were objections because it was a working class household, and I was suggesting that this only happened in working class households.
Bizarre.
A lot of it was bizarre. Some of it was worth listening to. Others, just no, I'd have dismissed it all.
What was the bit worth listening to?
Well, there were people from Ballymun objected to the fact that some of it was set or located in Ballymun, and they thought that they shouldn't be associated with that.
But it had to be set somewhere.
Well, my argument was, and still would be, that, you know, the thing is about Ballymun and other places, that it may be unique to Dublin, but it's kind of a universal setting. Or if you take the British Isles, if we can include ourselves in the British Isles, it's a universal setting. So it's not specific. Mm. So, but I think some people, not all, but some people in Ballymun saw it differently. And I did listen to some people and had conversations with them. But others, the fact that I was undermining marriage, I mean, marriage quite easily undermines itself on a regular basis. It doesn't need help from me. But I think the biggest shock for me was I opened up an envelope one morning and there's a death threat in it. Somebody, and there's a photograph of myself from a newspaper with "dead" written across the forehead, you know. And it was a long time before social media or email or anything like that. And you couldn't help thinking about somebody went to the trouble of getting an envelope, getting a stamp, putting that in the envelope, going down to a post box, putting it, I think it was Roddy Doyle, CO, care of RTE, and eventually found its way to me.
Yeah.
You know, and Eamon Dunphy wrote a hatchet job on me. Fair enough, he's totally entitled to. Mm. And I wrote, I can't even remember what it was, a little reply, smart arsed reply, and it got into the Sunday Independent, but they published my address, not just the area I lived in, Colester, my whole address. And there was a deluge of letters then after that.
And you have small children at home?
We had two at the time, yeah, 3 and 2. Yeah. So even something as small as going down to the shops for a bottle of milk, it was in bottles those then, or it might be in carton, I'm not sure, but milk and bread at the end of the day, thinking, what do we need for tomorrow? The shop, you know, is a 5-minute walk on the Artane roundabout close to where I lived, and I'd often bring one or both of the kids, and we'd, you know, it's a 5-minute walk, but when you're with a child that age, it could take half an hour to get there and half an hour coming back because everything is fascinating. But for a few days, I was saying, no, I'd better not. I'll just go on my own.
At home. And that was also because your mother was confronted.
Yeah, that was worse than anything. She lived in Kilbarrick, and on Kilbarrick Road, one of her neighbours literally pushed her. I think my mother would have been about 60 at the time.
Yeah.
And the neighbour, who she'd known all the years she lived in Kilbarrick, and it was the only house she ever lived in her married life, so from 1951 to the day she died. And this person who she'd known more than 30 years at this stage, actually more than 40 years, pushed her and said if I was her son, she'd be ashamed of me. That's how deep it went. Yeah.
Extraordinary.
It is. It's hard to imagine now.
1994.
We're talking about. Not 1894. 1994, yeah.
And it was in the news and everything for
it
quite
was.
Some time.
That was the big. Like, I went to bed having watched it, wake up Wednesday morning, you know, can't visualise exactly, but the usual routine, feeding the kids or whatever, stick on the news, half listening to it. And it was actually, I think, the second item on the news.
Yeah.
And it remained that way for a week.
I have a clip here, which you probably haven't heard since back then. Family was broadcast on the 3rd of May. And the following morning, this is Morning Ireland.
The RTE switchboard had one of its busiest nights for a long time last night. The calls were prompted by the showing of the first episode of Roddy Doyle's 4-part series, Family, described by one commentator as a warts-only view of working-class Dublin life. RTE says most of the reaction last night was negative. Here's one caller.
We were warned it was raw and brutal, and many viewers would undoubtedly be shocked, which I suppose was why I was interested to watch it. But I was utterly disgusted. Its portrayal of explicit sex scenes, its glamorizing of crimes of robberies, talk of kidnap and severing of fingers, its portrayal of violence against the wife and in front of the family. It does not matter what the next 3 episodes show, even if Jarlow becomes a saint, I will not watch it and would hope public opinion will demand its withdrawal.
I shouldn't laugh, you know.
Well, how did he expect Charlie to become a sage after that first episode? But
the objection to domestic violence being depicted in front of the children, as if it didn't happen, or as if it's more important not to show it than it is a factual thing, you know, a horrible reality. I just find that brilliant. It's brilliant. I can laugh at it now, but that's what I was hearing the following morning.
It's the thunderous chorus of denial, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But it's grist to the mill in a way, you know. I was just thinking, when I hear that, I don't. It's easy to feel a bit smug and I think, well, I was right and he was wrong. But at the time, I would have felt, I'm doing something right here. I really did feel that.
You were going out of your way. You should have been cashing in at this point.
I suppose so, yeah, but that was never...
You wanted to raise the subject.
In some ways, on a human level, one of the great things, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with the content of the thing itself, but after I won the Booker Prize, constantly inundated with requests to turn up at this thing, to be photographed with a racehorse that had won a cup, to open this supermarket, to kiss this baby or whatever, it all stopped.
Is that right?
It stopped for years.
For years?
Yeah, nothing.
All because of that?
Yeah. And for that alone, I felt grateful. It was great. It sort of cleaned life in a way.
Go away.
Yeah. But I had and have great friends and we'd meet for a pint when we could. You know, we'd all had small children or whatever. But without saying anything, they positioned themselves. So I'd be in the local and they'd position themselves in such a way that we could continue to have the chat, talking about football and stuff like that. And they were in such a position that other people couldn't get at me. And it's not that people were trying to hit me or anything like that, but where so many people wanted to get right up to my face to tell me how right I was or how wrong I was. And it was kind of really awkward for a while. But in terms of becoming something of a national treasure or whatever, that just stopped. It was, you know, the one thing that at home we agreed on, that this is brilliant.
But you were obviously shook, you know. It was very tough.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you felt that you had still done the right thing.
Oh yeah, I was very proud. I think it's probably the only thing really, I'm not, you know, how do you measure pride? But I've never felt proud about anything I've done. Proud, very proud of my children. But with family, particularly the final episode, I really felt I'd done a good job there. And I think everybody involved did a great job, but I felt I'd done a good job. And as much as a writer can affect society and social change or the debate or whatever, the conversation, whatever you want to call it, I'd done a good job there. And I felt really good about it.
Remember as well, the following year, 1995, is the divorce referendum.
Yeah.
So we have to assume it contributed in some way to that
conversation. Oh, I'm taking entire responsibility. And all the other referenda as well. That was me and me only.
I want to play another clip from that week in May because it builds and builds all week. And we heard Morning Ireland on the Monday morning. Mm-hmm. And then by Friday, of course, it's on The Late Late Show. And we hear the mix of opinions from the Late Late audience. Have a listen to this.
It's excellent when you see drama that actually makes you think. Creating something within you that you say, God, that's awful, or God, that's great, right, or something like that. Right. So it's terrific to see something
like
that.
Yes, sir.
Well, my point was that where I did enjoy it, I just felt that the scene where the husband grabbed the wife by the hair and pulled her towards the table, I certainly was shocked with that, and I wondered whether it was really necessary. But I did enjoy the
Okay. All right, let's go over to Silent Nights over here.
I thought it was very true to life.
Yeah.
I thought what the man just said there about the husband dragging the wife by the hair of the head, that was so shocking. But the thing is that is what happens.
Yes, ma'am. What were you saying to me?
Well, I just said that I looked at the programme with my daughter.
Your daughter.
Who was 29. Mm. And when the programme had ended, I said, 3 cheers for Roddy Doyle. It's time it was exposed. It is going on.
About taking the completely opposite view, I thought the whole lot was absolutely dreadful. On the grounds that I'm from the North Side, I'm from a working class North Side area. And I have never seen that type of life. I haven't lived that type of life. The shots that were shown of Ballymun were... I was heartsick for the people in Ballymun. to be honest with you.
I just want to come back on one thing that lady in front of me said. I don't think the programme is actually set in undermining people's lives and people's values. But if anyone doesn't actually believe this actually goes on, give them 20 minutes with me in the car park or the shopping centre, in Ballymun or any of its twinned areas in the city or indeed the country, and they'll really open their eyes.
Well done.
Wow, that last woman.
All of them. I mean, it's just... It's extraordinary hearing that. I was there, I think. I was in the...
You were, yes.
I was,
on that late.
Yeah.
6th of May, 1994.
Yeah. absolutely terrified. But it's, you know, I just feel hearing those voices 30 years later, I just personally feel great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vindicated.
I felt that at the time. I still feel it now.
The conversation wasn't about it, something that was so hidden.
Yes, you could hear people, and even the objection, was it necessary? You know, the man said he enjoyed it, which is good as well, because it was there to be enjoyed in that, you know, depending on which way you look at the word enjoyed. But
entertainment and education, I would think.
Yeah, I'm not sure about education, but, you know, thought-provoking maybe and shocking. Okay. But the fact that he thought that there were people who remembered him actually hitting Jer or Paula on screen, that never happened.
No.
And I still, to this day, meet people who tell me they watched it with their mother and it had a huge impact and the mother wanted them to see it.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. People quietly tell me this, you know, but even quite recently, yeah.
Was it ever repeated by RTÉ?
Don't think so, no.
No.
I remember David Blake Knox, who was, I think, head of drama, not sure what his formal... He was very much behind it.
Yeah.
And I think he phoned me 2 days afterwards and said there'd been a meeting of the RTÉ board and they decided to go ahead with broadcasting the other three episodes, which really shocked me because I wouldn't have thought there was any doubt that they were going to. But I think they were, the level of hostility to it.
The board had met.
Some of them, I think, would be quite happy to have pulled the plug altogether, you know.
Wow.
So that angered me a bit, although I was grateful to David.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that some people in the organisation would have been happier if it had never been broadcast, because I think, you know, it did really muddy the water after Riverdance.
It did. Because
which wasn't my intention, I've got to say.
Because early in the year in this programme, we were reviewing 1994 because of the Riverdance and USA 94, and there was the IRA ceasefire there. And you were writing the Irish Times that... like so many who often reflect on that Riverdance anniversary, we, like all of those people, we didn't mention family.
Yeah, no, I just thought that was me personally, because I always associate... Riverdance was extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. I remember watching it. You know, I'd be one of these people who doesn't watch the Eurovision but watches the bit when they're collating the votes.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was amazing, absolutely amazing. And I always associate Riverdance with what I knew was coming up 4 days later, the first episode of The Family. So when I hear if I'm walking by that pub on Bachelor's Walk where they do some sort of Riverdance thing virtually in the window,
that's right, yes.
I always think of family when I'm walking
that's
by
bizarre,
that.
Yeah.
But it's only me.
I was trying to think why we would have overlooked it. And I think kind of in searching for those moments of Ireland growing up and sort of finding confidence and joy, that family doesn't really fit in there, does it?
Yeah, well, that's part of the article was just exploring that. Why is it that, you know, RTÉ, you would have thought 30th anniversary that they'd broadcast it.
I'd love to see that.
Half the adult population of Ireland watched the first episode, more watched the second, more watched the third, and more again watched the fourth. Mm. It was huge at the time.
Huge.
It's not just me. It wasn't just my personal...
It's not your imagination.
It was absolutely huge.
And the player is there for these kind
exactly,
of things.
Exactly, yeah.
There's brilliant music in it. It's a fantastic soundtrack because it's 90s hits.
Yeah, and each character has their own song. And the use of Sinead O'Connor in the fourth episode is just heartbreaking.
I haven't seen it because it's hard to get hold of. Uh-huh. It is on DVD.
It is, yeah.
Did it come out at the time on DVD?
No. There was a problem with music rights, I think, as I understand it, because there's so much music.
Yeah.
But the BBC, I think, came to some sort of a arrangement, some sort of generic arrangement about music rights.
Maybe someone in drama will hear our conversation and it could pop up on the RTÉ player.
That'd be great.
You'd love to see that.
Oh, I'd love to.
And you haven't seen it yourself since?
No.
God. It's incredible. It has aged really well. I've only seen one episode but has aged incredibly well. Okay, if we just hold there for a moment, Roddy, because we have to take a quick break, but we will be back shortly. 51551, that's the text. And you're very welcome back. Roddy Doyle is still with us. That's our long-winded way of introducing Paula Spencer.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned the woman who walked into doors, which also became a play.
A play and an opera.
And an opera.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And then Paula Spencer was simply the name of the follow-up
yes,
10 years later.
It was called that because I couldn't think of anything else.
That's okay. And now we have nearly 20 years later, we have this one. So where is Paula Spencer now in this story?
Paula is 66 now, and the book starts with her coming home from her first COVID vaccination on the 7th of May, 2021. Not coincidentally, I also had my first COVID vaccination on the 7th of May, 19. Get me centuries.
All these stories is Roddy Doyle wandering around. To go, this is a novel now.
Yeah. So I went to the Helix, as does Paula. Hugely impressed by what I witnessed. Not just the efficiency of it, but the tone of it. Everybody was so friendly. In a huge queue with people my own age, all of us over 60, a lot of people listening to the side. I was thinking, is this the hip replacements or the vaccinations?
That's very funnily done. You're kind of
men in grey and you, women with a bit of colour.
A part of Paula is you, let's face it. Yeah.
On the way home, I was feeling elated, just a bit elated, you know, not so elated that I couldn't drive the car, but just feeling this is the beginning of the end. I had been writing a novel before COVID started, and I binned it, the only thing I've ever binned, really, given up on completely, because it was set in the present day, and then by March 2020, the present day, as we understood it, didn't exist anymore, it was gone. And I was reluctant to start a novel until I felt we're over this hump. And I thought that day, I felt if we're not over the hump, we're near the top of the hump. And I don't know what put it into my mind. I like to think that I was waiting for the lights to change at the corner of the Malahide Road and Collins Avenue. And I just thought, I wonder what Paula's feeling now.
Yeah.
She's the only character I've gone back to characters, but she's the only character I've created who I sometimes feel has an existence outside of the page.
Right.
You know? I often think about her.
She feels the most real to you?
Yeah, perhaps. And I think maybe because she was so difficult to achieve, to get the hang of her, particularly when it came to writing the novel, to make sure every word was hers. It was a hard job, you know?
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's fine. It's not supposed to be easy, but it was a hard job. And then having got there, I had no intention of writing another book, but then I wanted to write something that reflected the times during what became known as the Celtic Tiger. And I thought, well, she'd be a good judge. And then later, 20 years later, in this COVID thing and coming out the other end, I thought, well, yeah, maybe Paula would be a good judge again, see how she's getting on.
I love Paula.
Yeah, well, so do
and
I.
She's in a good place here at the start of the novel because she's clean from alcohol.
Yeah, for
she's
quite a while now.
Laughing away to Marion Keyes' books, loves her satsumas, all the details. Texting
I'm fond of a satsuma myself.
Charles, we know, is long dead. She's a new fella, Joe, who she texts every
now
and again.
She meets him towards the end of Paula Spencer.
Is that right?
Yeah,
okay,
so they've been an item for 20
that,
years.
Yeah. So everything seems to be quite comfortable in her world.
Yeah.
Until it's not.
Yeah. The bell rings and it's her daughter who has been, in a way, mothering Paula for the last 3 decades. And she has just walked out of her house. Her daughter's called Nicola. She's now in her... She was played by Nellie Conroy Family. She's now in her late 40s, menopausal. I always visualise her as putting on her armour every morning. She took on the world and winning. She was winning.
Very successful.
Huge inspiration. Paula uses words like glorious and goddess to describe her daughter, you know, and kind of resents her in ways as well, that complicated thing. Absolutely adores her, but resents her strength or whatever. But she puts on the armour. I can see the clothes, just the right makeup, and she goes on and faces a world that's controlled by men, really, and wins. And she's made a huge, however you measure it, a success of her life. And she's kind of looked after her mother, but the armour's come off. And this is where COVID becomes actually a boon from my point of view, because without giving too much away, they're in the house together and Paula senses there's something big is coming down here. Mm. Something big is happening here. And she uses the opportunity. She lets the world outside know they both have COVID. They both have the COVID, so you can't come near us for 10 days.
She makes it up.
She makes it up.
So had this beautiful time of isolation.
Well, beautiful, no.
It's a very long and difficult conversation between mother and
daughter. That I knew, yeah. For me, the structure of the book was important because I knew it was going to be a long, excruciating conversation, you know, and I knew I'd broad strokes, but it's a bit like deciding to tell somebody something and then the conversation goes on for 2 hours, but you actually had only planned one thing that you were going to say. You know that? Yeah. So there's so much planning in it. But I knew that if I went straight into the conversation, it would kill the book in a way. So there had to be more to it. So I kind of start it, then go on with Paula's life and then go back to it. And that was how the book was structured.
We can't give away too much there, but it's also a very funny story. And
That's Paula. That's Paula's sense of humour.
And her relationship with Mary.
Mary, I think, Mary's a new character. She isn't in any of the previous books. And Mary is, that phrase, a godsend, in that she's become very quickly Paula's best pal, her mate. And they work together part-time in the local cleaners. And if you have to say, you know, what makes Paula's life worth living? You point at Mary in a way, because they're going to share. They're going to have a, you know, they're going to share their moments. They're going to look at each other and burst out laughing for the rest of their lives. That's what you'd like to think. That's why their friendship is so important.
To let people know, Mary's the sort of character who cuts open an avocado and says, ah, Bruce Willis got here before me.
Yeah.
I love that one.
I often, when I come up with these things, I never heard anybody say that. I come up with things. Is that actually funny? And I'm glad you're laughing there, because
so she's a gas character. And you capture that love between two women in their 60s and how much they need each other and how important. It's love, isn't it?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Do you know, if I'm at a football match and I go to football matches, or if I'm in the pub even, you see men now in their 60s and sometimes, like, they're big men, you know, and sometimes it's no longer, when I was a kid, they just nod at each other. You know, or if now and again they shake hands.
Yeah.
But now they often, like, it's two bears coming at each other and they, you know, they hug each other in a way that was never the case. So we've become a bit huggy. A bit too huggy, perhaps. But Mary and Paul are like that. They're like two bears, you know. Mm. So it's a physical thing as well. Yeah, arms around each other. And they even kiss each other on the lips at one stage.
The lovely thing is that you capture Dublin today as well, as you did back in 1994.
I hope so.
Because you've got Deliveroo drivers and the kind of gimlet-eyed view we have of these foreigners, as Paula herself is calling them. There are tents pitched in Dublin city centre, which was the previous problem of just homelessness, which is something else now, of course. Seagulls as well. People who can't afford the simple grocery items.
Yeah.
Is this a Dublin that you're portraying now to be pitied rather than, you know, it was once admired or at least affectionately
no,
seen?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's a Dublin, to me, it's not pity one would want. A bit of justice would come in handy. A bit of long-term thinking, planning, whatever. A bit of respect for people who don't generally get heard. But it's Dublin as I see it. And it's Dublin as I love it as well. Now, I don't like the tents. I don't, there's, you know. But, I mean, when The Commitments came out, and everybody can, people remember The Commitments now as if with nostalgia. But I remember some of the criticisms of The Commitments when it came out in 1991 was that the depiction of Dublin was so grim and that nobody would come to Dublin.
Yeah.
Now, within a couple of years, The Commitments has been somehow or other sucked into the tourist industry.
Yes, it has.
You know, and there are Japanese tourists wandering Darndale looking for exactly which house Jimmy Rabbit lived in, you know. So these things eventually become so. But Dublin, you know, back then, people do get nostalgic. Now, that's understandable. But I'm not interested in depicting Dublin today and contrasting it negatively as compared to 30 years ago, because I think, I mean, 30 years ago wasn't a lot to be to write home about.
No.
You know, all I can say is that I love the place and I love, you know, and it's like, what's the measure of that? And it's the people.
I was thinking about you because Rosie, obviously, is such a great story. This, again, is not a novel. It was a film about the homeless crisis, people, particularly families living in hotels who are homeless. And I was thinking about the visibility of issues, because that's essentially what you do with family. You make the domestic violence issue suddenly visible because it's an invisible problem.
Yeah.
The tents we discussed now in terms of immigration, because they're so visible, whereas the homelessness of Rosie story, they're invisible and we don't talk so much about it anymore, even as the figures go up and up and up, because we only have a monthly figure.
Yeah, well, when Rosie was released, the figure was what it had hit an unacceptable 10,000, and I think it's hitting 15,000 now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 14,500.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's really, you know, and when you think it, in sometimes, like, we're one of the wealthiest countries in the world, you know, we can't avoid realising that we're part of a huge, big economic union. And 14,500, it isn't all that many people.
No.
Do you know, it's not all that many people. So it's a bit, still a bit inexplicable. I think it's the will. Do you know, in the bad old days of the 1930s or whatever, thousands upon thousands of houses were built.
Yeah.
Land was found. Thousands of houses.
And we've never run out of workers to build offices and hotels in the last 10
years. Well, exactly,
which is extraordinary when you hear, where are the workers coming from?
Yeah.
Maybe they stopped building offices, empty offices. It's again that, it's that visibility issue of Dublin. But as you say, it's a Dublin that you still love.
Yeah, very much so.
And you still wander around the same places.
Not the same places. Sometimes. I'd be a creature of habit, and I'm aware of that, so I try not to be too... it was pointed out to me once, do you realise you cross the road in the exact same place every time we go down there? I said, I don't want to be the man who crosses the road in the exact same
place. So now you zigzag.
So now I don't. I go in the opposite direction. But I do wander around, not with any great point. I'm not taking notes, but I kind of... Well, I've never been down here before, so I'll go down there. So a part of my day generally is just wandering around.
But you never moved, did you, with the success, even after what happened with family and
no,
so
never
on.
Moved. No, actually, I'm not sure if we even thought about that after family, because it was a bit nerve-wracking. No, I don't think so.
Was Paddy Clark your biggest hit?
Commercially, I think, yeah. I'm betting it was by a distance, yeah.
Because it was number one in Britain as well as Ireland for...
For a long, long time. It was number one here for over a year, I think. Yeah, it was huge.
Sold in America as well.
It did, I
translated.
Think. Yeah, it's probably the only book I've had that sold in numbers in America, I think.
Because I found a 1994 interview you did with the LA Times where you talk about Hollywood being a place you've no interest in at all.
Well, that's true. And I didn't. I don't control my Wikipedia page. Somebody else put it up there. But at one point it said that I lived in Monte Carlo.
Just to confirm,
I've never been to Monte Carlo, but I lived there, and it says that I grew up in Dalkey, which is wrong.
Oh, geez, that's much worse.
But I find it amusing, so I've left it like that.
Do you still call in to pubs for a quiet pint?
I call in for a quiet pint, and if I'm after, say, if I'm going to see Bohemians, I'm into the Hut in Phibsborough for a loud pint. And a louder one after. But yeah, so I do, I'm a great believer in the quiet pint, yeah. I would often deliberately miss the bus so I can have...
the one more
I can
pint.
Say, oh no, I've missed my bus, and then, you know.
Would people not shuffle away from Roddy Doyle coming in for his pint, going, oh, he's getting his next two pints thing now from us?
Well, there's no shortage of bald men with glasses in the city, so it's easy. And the name Doyle doesn't make people sit up either, you know. So I think it's easy enough. Somebody very close to me once said, yeah, you know, not so long ago, have you any idea how many people look at you? And I said, no.
So you're unaware that everyone goes, there's Roddy
Doyle. A decision I made years ago, possibly I wasn't even aware of it.
Don't even look.
And people are great, you know, people just leave me alone. And the ones that... most people who don't even know me just say, how are you, Roddy? So it's kind of like I'm part of the furniture of the city, maybe, which, you know, it's a nice place to be.
Is it Rodney, by the way? Is that the original?
Roderick.
Yeah. Roderick Doyle.
My father got Rory. He was christened Roderick as well. He was born the first anniversary of the execution of Rory O'Connor, the Republican,
yeah.
One of the 77 men who was executed. So a little act of sedition. He was named... Roderick, because Rory O'Connor had originally been Roderick.
Roderick.
Changed his name to Rory as part of the, you know, the nationalist.
That's your dad who became an avid Fianna Fáiler.
Yeah, yeah. The only bad thing about my father. But so he was Roderick, and he was known as Rory. I was Roderick, and I was known as Roddy.
Another thing you love to do is to do very different things, don't you?
I have no idea what you mean. Well,
you jump from very different kind of genre. You had a Dublin adaptation of Peter Pan. Yeah. In the Gates.
Sorry, when you said you jumped, I thought somebody had told you I jumped from a plane.
No. You did very different books for Kelly and, of course, Roy Keane as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you still following the adventures of Roy Keane?
Well, yeah, I'm a huge admirer of Roy, and working on the book was an extraordinary experience, brilliant, you know, and I think we both really enjoyed it. So when you do something like that, you can't help but feel a huge regard, and I'd feel that for Kelly as well, you know.
Yeah.
But those, I could, if I had to specify what it is I do for a living, if I was filling in a form, I'd writer wasn't specific enough, I'd put down novelist. Because that's where most of my head goes.
Is it?
All the
Despite all the plays.
Yeah, all the other things generally have been, like, I got an email in 2013, about a line and a half, would I be interested in writing a book with Roy Keane?
Right.
Now, it wasn't me thinking, oh, I'd like to do a book with Roy Keane. Somebody else planted the idea.
To you. Great idea. Brilliant
More
idea.
More recently, I was in the kitchen, chopping onions or something, text pings, it's Kelly Harrington. How are you, Roddy? There's talk of a book. Would you be interested in meeting me? And I gave it a minute's thought, and I thought, yeah, I'd love to meet her.
That came about.
And we both decided to write the book. So, but that was Kelly's idea. I'm not sure if it was originally Roy's idea or if it was somebody put the idea to Roy. The same with a lot of the plays. My first play, Brown Bread, it was the two men who ran the Passion Machine Theatre Company, John Sutton and Paul Mercier. They asked me, would I write a play?
37 years ago.
Your maths are better than mine, yeah. Is it 37 years?
According to various, I can't remember where it looked.
37, God.
It could be more now. Yeah. not less.
The same year Alex Ferguson started at Manchester United.
Oh, there you go. That's how you remember dates. That's what we know. Would you go with Kelly again? Because that ends in winning the medal in Tokyo, and a lot has happened since.
I was really intrigued. Well, I was so thrilled that she won the medal, but watching the fights, she just made it obvious in each fight she'd won. There was no, there were no brown envelope moments, in the judges' decisions. But I felt what really moved me was how happy she seemed.
Unbelievable.
Whereas I don't think she was immediately happy when she won the first one.
No.
And I think it was rough. There was nobody there. It was still, there was no audience or whatever. But just seeing her dancing in the...
dancing on her own on the campus. That was something else.
And then I missed the singing, but she just seemed so happy. So I don't think there's a book there, but there certainly, if somebody was interested in an extra chapter.
Oh, right. OK. An update to the original.
Yeah, I haven't talked to her about it. And I don't know if there'd be any interest or even if she'd be interested. But
I have some suggestions for you, Roddy, for your next thing. Do you have your thing yet? Well, you can tell us afterwards. Do these ones first. I'd love a young person memoir of Barry Keoghan. By Roddy Doyle. I think you could get under the skin. Fascinating character.
Barry Keoghan, yeah, possibly. I wonder, though, would I be able to pin him down for half an hour?
That might be the challenge. That's the challenge. Or how about the inner life of someone in Dublin who's decided along the way, because they do decide to become far right. I prefer to call them feral right, because there's far right, which is kind of a mismatch of ideology. Then there's the feral right, who don't see anything but their cause of get them out. Ireland is full.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. An interesting conversation. Whether I'd want to write it or not, I don't know.
Oh, right.
I think there's too much of a ready. After the riot, November 12 months ago, the speed with which politicians and other people started referring to scumbags was just shocking.
Yeah,
I felt.
And thugs.
Just shocking. And it's not to say that the riots were justifiable. They weren't. They were atrocious, absolutely atrocious. But the speed with which a whole class of people and a whole age group of people sometimes were being dismissed in that way. So there is something interesting there, but I don't know.
The Minister for Justice you're quoting there.
I am, among other people, yeah.
Use the term.
And otherwise, quite a competent Minister for Justice, I would have thought. But the speed with which it happened, I just thought, says a lot about our politicians.
Are you saying that they are just look at a set of young people from a certain place in that way?
I am, yeah. I think life is always a bit more complicated than that.
What, in your head, was the cause of those riots?
Well, there was a certain goading by the far right, obviously. I don't understand social media and I don't know how, you know, I don't really know how it operates, the speed with which it operates. So I'd have to step back there. But there's a certain amount of goading. There's a certain amount of manipulation. There's a certain amount of what used to be called Bowsyism. The opportunity was there. A lot of things conjoin at the same time and it happened. But it's ugly. It's really, really terrible. Doesn't reflect what the vast majority of people think. But I don't think there was just one uniform type of person, because I was in town that evening, you know, before it kicked off.
Right.
But I had a hint that things were happening because of the, you know, people getting off the Lewis on my way to the bus stop. Mm-hmm. And I was thought, this isn't a Thursday night crowd, you know. So I knew, and there were a lot of faces being hidden and things like that. But yeah. I think it's just a nonsense to brand everybody, you know, with that label. But yeah, there's an interesting conversation there, I think, but I'm not sure I'd want to have that conversation.
You don't want to go there. Do you have your next thing in your head?
I'm working on a novel, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us anything about it.
Well, I'm using my teaching years. I was a teacher for 14 years and I've never written about it. And I'm not interested in memoir. So it's not a recollection of my teaching time, you know, because anyway, if I was even trying that, I mean, I started teaching in 1979 and that's even more than, that's 45 years ago, is it?
45.
And I've kind of vivid memories of the first class I taught, but I'm not going to pretend I remember what I said the first time or what the first child said to me or what her or his name was. So I'm not interested in capturing my own life as a teacher, but I am interested in capturing the world as it was to the teacher, from the teacher's point of view. And because it was an amazing time, 1979 to 1993, Ireland did an awful lot of living in those 14 years and an awful lot of changing, you know.
Yeah.
Corporal punishment was legal when I started teaching. Now, it was never policy in the school I was in, but it was, strongly advised do not hit a child, but it wasn't actually illegal until, I think, my second year as a teacher.
Unreal. I want to finish by bringing that thought back to Paula Spencer, because I think as a teacher is when you first spot that there are issues in homes.
There is that opportunity, I think, you know, it's a bit like a doll's house. You go into a classroom and you're standing in front of a doll's house with the front, that big front door open, and you're looking into 30 rooms. And it's not that you're invading privacy. I've never did, never interested, never asked children prying questions. But you can't help wondering sometimes, I'm going back now, say 1982, and I'm looking at 27 pink-cheeked kids looking up at me wondering what's this mad man going to say today, and looking then at maybe three or four grey-faced kids who obviously haven't slept well, whose clothes haven't been washed, whose uniform isn't all there fully. There's holes at the elbows very early in the school year. They look tired. And you can't help wondering. There's a balance there. And it was an amazing job to have, really, because in one level you're supposed to be, you know, transferring the curriculum from your head to theirs and to rush them towards certification and, you know, the whole leave and cert tyranny. Mm. And on the other hand, you're learning. You know, I think I don't want to sound pompous, but I think a good teacher goes into a classroom and comes out having learnt something.
Very good.
Yeah.
Listen, Roddy, your work is never without a point, and it's a credit to you that you've opened our eyes several times over the years to what's right in front of us, actually, in many ways. But it's no harm that we have a bit of fun along the way, too.
Exactly.
The Women Behind the Door, that's the new novel, Roddy, by Roddy Doyle. It's published by Jonathan Cape. It's available in shops and libraries right now. You're going to be in conversation with Donal Ryan on the 10th of November. People can get tickets from dublinbookfestival.com. Roddy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good luck.